So, I was talking to Martha.
Oh yeah?
Her neighbors got raided by SWAT.
Wow.
It turns out they were listening to Reality Exploit Roundtable.
When all you have is a search engine, everything looks like a database.
Let's move on.
Privacy is nothing to be granted. Privacy is something you take yourself.
They've got the Mossad, the CIA, and Hillary Clinton behind them.
We're now beyond what the Stasi could even dream of.
Reality Exploit Roundtable.
Welcome. Our panelists today are Voodoo, of Black and White Yellow Pages and Beer Can fame, Smuggler, Anarplex.net, Plato, of Twitter and Reddit, and Hero, from Agorist Radio, and I'm Wise Guy, the man with no name. First up, it used to be said that freedom of the press belongs to those who own presses. The internet has made everyone a publisher, and it's revolutionizing journalism. Breakthroughs in manufacturing through 3D printing may soon enable making firearms without visiting a gun shop or a machinist. Play the intro clip.
The Defense Distributed Project has developed an idea that we're calling the WikiWeapon. It would be the world's first 3D printable personal defense system. We're trying to port to the RepRap model. Now, this isn't the first time a 3D printable gun has been suggested as an idea, and that's not even important. The product isn't our emphasis here. What we're interested in producing is a digital file. The file itself, to be shared across the internet. Let me explain. So consider this. A CAD file containing the information for a 3D printable weapon system. If that file was seeded by 30 people, let's say, as long as there's a free internet, that file is available to anyone at any time, all over the world. Now, a gun can be anywhere. Any bullet is now a weapon.
Hero, is the right to keep and bear arms about to get a huge boost?
Yeah, it appears so. It's fascinating about this clip. If you watch it, they say, well, you know, we may only be able to make a gun that's usable one time. And they're putting the CAD files up and with that's being operated with open source software, and people are going to be able to download this file and print out the parts themselves and modify them and then upload them. So it's going to be this collaborative thing. And who knows what kind of weapon that they're going to be able to provide. But I think another thing that's big here in the clip, I don't remember the exact quote, but he said that this wasn't about the guns, this was about the file. And this was about a new age. And he made this statement about how we're entering a new age with this 3D microfab equipment, and archives and things being shared between people. And so pretty soon people are going to be able to print out weapons. It's not going to be a question of whether people like have a right. Everybody's going to have it. I mean, there may be people that are going to be crushing down on people who actually do have guns, but it's similar like P2P and file sharing. So this is also just going to – it's a vision of what's going to happen in the future with what happens when the 3D printable gun is something from Smith & Wesson. And or any other type of device that you can print out that somebody has some government monopoly on the design. You know, where we're going to go from here, I think it's going to get very complicated and fascinating.
And scary.
And fun.
It would seem that one of the problems for manufacturing realistically operational firearms is the high chambers that are created when a regular firearm is used. However, in the 1960s or 70s, there was a company called Gyrojet, which manufactured very small rockets the size of, well, large caliber rounds. And they would fire out of the muzzle with almost no high pressure in the chamber. Now, they had problems as far as accuracy, and there were problems as far as acceleration to the target, etc. But I think with current technology, you could probably manufacture the rockets themselves using 3D printing, and then you would relax considerably the chamber pressures in the firearm, making it possible to make a firearm that would be able to fire many, many rounds and still be operational.
And I thought I was scared before.
Well, and these guys aren't about repeatability. They're not about accuracy. Cody Wilson makes it very clear that this is about putting the file out there, even if it's a one-shot, single-use thing. It's about putting the file out there where anybody can grab it and put it on their rep wrap and be able to repeat it. It's interesting. Cody was on the Anarchy Gumbo podcast with Michael W. Dean, and very, very incredible interview. I think it'll be in the show notes here. But he said that he's been getting a lot of pushback from gun types who are, you know, just screaming, "Oh my God, you're ruining everything here." It's the typical crowd that you know, when all the cattle are in the pen, even though the area a certain cow might be in is legal area, it's too close to the fence for somebody, and everybody starts screaming that cow's too close to the fence. It was weird to see that gun guys would be so excited about that and worry about ruining everything.
I think it's interesting that the same technology is for the duplication and distribution of files for P2P and, you know, music and audio and the technologies like BitTorrent and these other disruptive file sharing type things. You hear the people say, well, we shouldn't have this and this is not a good thing. And it's interesting because the fact is that it's here and it can't be stopped. And if it can be stopped, it's only because a certain weaknesses and mechanisms that people are using to accomplish it, which can be bypassed through other types of sharing technology. So it's the same thing here, is that when someone says, I don't think that people should be able to print out 3D, I don't think that this is good, they're missing the point that the technology's here. They're going to do it. It's going to happen. This is what's happening. It's not whether you want it or not. It's what's the more interesting thing is, well, what are the implications of this happening? Similar to file sharing. File sharing's here. It's going to stay. It's never going away. What are the implications of that?
Well, the only real way against that would be taking down the internet completely and turning it into a government network and censor everything that someone thinks is kind of not so cool.
And then at that point, the gun files will still be distributed just like drugs right now, because the drugs aren't on the internet, and drugs still have a distribution channel. And if people want to get the files, they'll get them from their marijuana dealer in the same way that they get their weed. So, you know, we still can't stop it.
Yeah, Wilson's philosophy is it's really neat, and we can apply it. I started thinking about other areas where it could be applied to, something, you know, like a fully autonomous narco sub, you know, the hardware and software files for that, where you can load the sub in South America and have it autonomously navigate into the Mediterranean and ground itself until a transfer vessel comes to unload it. Things like that. Once that's out in the open, anybody can use it, and it would be a lot of fun to manufacture something like that and sell it to cartels. But even better if it's just available, and you have the capability of manufacturing it, but the file's available to everyone.
Yeah, that's key right there. It was the point of, can you do it? Can it be manufactured? Can it be duplicated? Can it be possibly 3D printed or some parts CNC'd and put together? Can it? And at that point, you know that it will. Then you go from there. Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, it's still a valid question to ask, should it be manufactured? Certainly, printing out a gun that shoots rockets is, you know, it's a weapon. That's something you need to do, maybe not, but it seems to me that it would be immoral to, if I was using my 3D printer to print out guns for, you know, the local gang, I would be totally open to signing up with some sort of protocol with other makers where we, you know, voluntarily sign a pledge that says, hey guys, we're not going to use our printers for weapons. I mean, that's one way to handle that risk.
Well, I think that the right to keep and bear arms and the right to free speech are on a par. And from my standpoint, I would not own any registered firearms for the same reason that I won't submit to having my pen or my computer system cataloged and registered. so that I can exercise free speech. Hero, I think that you brought up an interesting point about the drugs being delivered physically. That too may be coming to an end. As you know, there's quite a bit of research ongoing to create do-it-yourself biology and chemistry and on the desktop. When that happens, then the same file type of files that might be distributed now for 3D printing will instruct people's desktop chemistry or biology systems to manufacture organisms or modify them so that you won't have to be buying drugs through the mail. You'll just create them at home, and they'll all be designer drugs, and they'll be good.
Well, it's a lot more complicated to manufacture, you know, DMT than to squirt out some plastic into the shape of a cup.
At the moment, yes. In 2000, the DARPA-funded Total Information Awareness Project, a mass surveillance system, was defunded by Congress, and its leader, former National Security Advisor John Poindexter, fired when it was acknowledged that members of Congress might indirectly be targets of the system. Now Microsoft is helping New York City create an equally massive citywide surveillance system that could monitor anyone. The Kelly excerpt clip.
We'll show you how investigators get immediate access to information through live video feeds, and how detectives can access results of license plate readers and find a suspect, or map criminal history to reveal a pattern. We can track where a car associated with the murder suspect is currently located and where it's been over the past several days, weeks, or months. We apprehended a suspected killer that way in Queens soon after the license plate readers were put in place. If a suspicious package is left in front of a location, we can look back in time and see who left it there. Jessica will show you an example of that from just a few days ago. If one of our radiation detectors in the field sets off an alarm, the signal is sent here. We can determine quickly whether the sensor had detected a weapon, or more likely an individual who had just undergone some sort of medical procedure. We'll also show you how police commanders can query our databases to review and correlate crime information with how resources are deployed.
Smuggler, is this a paparazzi's wet dream? Will it reduce crime and eliminate terrorism in New York City? Will there be a backlash?
Well, good questions that, in my opinion, don't really hit the point. But anyways, is this a paparazzi's wet dream? Yes, of course, if the paparazzi is employed by the New York City's finest, will it reduce crime and, you know, battle terrorism? Maybe it will help with finding street criminals, but it won't eliminate terrorism, because terrorism, most of the time, terrorists don't care if they're caught after the act, especially since most of them are usually dead then. But the real question is, what will this do to everyday people? And what will it do to people that are not that much filling in the standard normal picture of a good citizen? I think it's showing that we have a trend for putting together all technology that there is, and creating some very efficient way to go back in time to correlate people and objects with each other. And I make it in a way that we don't need that many people to watch the whole system. And if you tie it in with all the other shit that's out there, I mean, face recognition systems, there's a new one from Hitachi that does several million face recognitions a second. Or there are people, projects like Trapwire that correlate data, or there's stuff like correlating the cell phone databases with the information from CCTV, or there's the index system. So essentially what we're seeing here is there's a real surveillance mega tool in the building, and it will be used. And it will be used against anyone who's not fitting the frame. So will there be a backlash? By whom? And will those people be willing to wear a mask to protect their privacy and pee on the front steps of City Hall?
And asking how it will affect people kind of ignores also the fact that it already has ignored people. Economically speaking, this is a case where the supplier determines how much is going to be supplied and the price point, and the consumer has no say in it. All the demand data, all the price data has been completely expunged from the equation. So there's no way of telling whether this system was needed or is demanded, or you know, the level of demand on it. I think in a stateless society, something like this will be demanded, but in that case, it would be the continuous auction instead of the continuous clamor that'll decide, you know, how big it is, how much data it collects, and how effective it is. Bloomberg said that this was done in collaboration with Microsoft, and that when Microsoft resells the software to other agencies, that New York City is going to get 30% of the proceeds. And he says, well, this is going to recoup our costs, and we might even make a profit. But he's got no basis of saying that. They expunged all of the price data and the demand data. You can't take a look at the counterfactual and say, what would have this money done if it was invested, you know, in some other fashion, or heaven forbid, left in the citizens' hands, in the residents of New York's hands, or you know, wherever the money came from. We cannot know what that counterfactual is. So he's got no basis for saying that they'll recoup anything or that it'll make a profit, because for all he knows, it might be a gigantic loss compared to what the counterfactual would have been.
Well, the thing is, it only shows that even robbers are doing bookkeeping.
Interesting point that you brought up there, Smuggler, was about the time history recording, because a lot of people hear these guys talking about the camera system, and they picture, you know, a room with, you know, 1,000 police officers sitting around 10,000 monitors, you know, watching all this stuff going on. And looking for red alerts popping up, little red lights flashing on certain monitors and stuff, when really we're talking about a system that's also recording. So they can go back in time on any street where they have these systems. They can go back 3 weeks ago at 3 o'clock in the morning and actually, you know, see the license plates passing by these places. So there's I think that is one of the biggest things that people just don't realize, is this is not just a big 3D system of surveillance. It's or 4D if you're talking time. It's just this whole three-dimensional recording of the entire city over time.
Exactly, and especially when you keep in mind that when you have the recording, you can bring in intelligence afterwards. So it might start with someone doing something in the face of the camera and being noticed for suspicious behavior. And then you go back in time and see, who is this guy meeting with? What car is he using? Which cars followed each other in a row through a license plate detector? And so on and so on. So essentially, you can go back and forth and apply new intelligence. And if you know what kind of intelligence you need, you will be able to script that. So sooner or later, you'll have a scripting database at the hand of a few policemen. I mean, we're talking about a few dozen people needed to surveil a city like New York City with a system like that.
Now I'm really, really, really scared.
And suddenly it becomes, hey, you know, Mr. Smith's awfully critical of the New York Police Department. I wonder where he goes every Tuesday at 3 in the afternoon. This hotel. And he just happens to meet, and this other lady happens to show up at the same time. I wonder what Mr. Smith's wife's going to think about that. I'm sure that would never happen, but, you know, the possibility's there.
No, we can trust our system. Abuse will never happen.
And, of course, we have safeguards put in place to take care of it in case there is any abuse.
Except there are no safeguards in place. Bloomberg made that very clear, that there were no safeguards in place other than his and Ray Kelly's word.
Yeah, who's watching The Watchmen?
The experience of the Globe newspaper in UK, I think, is instructive as to what happens when people in the journalism business have access to information from law enforcement and other sources that legally they have no right to. And his entire empire has taken a massive hit financially, but it's really hurt journalism and law enforcement too, and people's confidence that their public servants are actually out doing their job instead of lining their pockets or doing things they have no business engaging in.
And that is news.
So in that sense, this is all a good news story.
Well, I think it also possibly brings up a new market for countermeasures so that people can use means that aren't very obvious to hide their identities and their movements. For example, most of the cameras, as has been pointed out, that are used for surveillance operate into the slight near-infrared, which means that it's possible to project patterns on the surfaces that are being used for identification and obfuscate them. License plates, for example, could easily disappear if you were projecting light and dark infrared patterns that messed up the identification. People's faces might be impossible to recognize if they had infrared camouflage being placed on them, things of that nature. And I think that we may see markets emerge for doing just that.
Well, I'd like to throw in something here. The problem really is that we're not so much talking about the cameras here, but the real thing is the correlation between multiple data sources. If those are cameras that are installed by the city, or in the case of New York, a lot of them are operated by private businesses. But I am coming from a city where there are millions of tourists every year. And every one of those fucking tourists, has a smartphone or a digital camera and takes photos all the time of everyone that's not quick enough to hide. And this is timestamped. This goes on the internet. It will be on Facebook. It's geolocated. And even that is a potential data source to put into a correlation system like the main awareness or Trapwire or whatever. I mean, even the EFF had a report on that over the last days of the FBI wanting to do that. So what we're looking here at is we have millions and millions of sensors, many of them operated not by the government, but by private people, and those private people, you know, distribute the data everywhere. And I don't want this to become an arms race between people that think that there's a loophole with a certain generation of cameras. If IR blinding works, or IR patterns projecting works, it works for a while, but after a while, it will be taken out. And then what you're doing? So essentially, to protect yourself, you cannot be going the less obvious path by now. You have to make a statement. You have to say, you know, screw you all. I'm going to protect my privacy no matter what. And whoever looks at me sharply for doing that, he is a collaborator of tyranny.
Or people will be wearing masks or faceplates constantly.
Absolutely.
When they're out and about.
I think that's the only technology we have against it.
If I can throw in two little alternate comments here. Over on the Global Gorillas blog with John Robb, I think in the middle of last year or so, he had an article which talked about the feasibility of remote monitoring and controlling of law enforcement at the local federal level from a remote location. Which it was actually hinting at possibly very little police or federal police even located near the city, and everything being just completely controlled and run, not by this like occupying army that's there, but literally just by drones and video cameras and the rest. So that's an excellent article. I'll try to like post that onto the show notes. And then the other thing here is that there is an alternative here that can be that people can try to work toward also, and that is private cities. And I know this may be difficult now, but you can still do it on a small scale and with small communities. Is that like the Burb Claves and Snow Crash? We like to bring that up here on the show a lot. Lots of stuff in there by Neal Stephenson in his books, but the technology for, social systems where people come together and they have their own environment, they have their own little miniature city, and there's no cameras there. And so independent nation state, independent cities, I'm not sure the term right now, but that is something in the future that people might want to be involved with, because New York may be a lost cause. Chicago, all these big cities, they may be just totalitarian till the end of time, and there's just no way out of getting these machines. So alternate systems may be a way.
Second round for the win.
the Matrix cometh. Moving on, Australian Federal Police and Customs are beating their chests over the recent arrest of a man they say bought illegal drugs using Bitcoin on a Tor-hosted Silk Road service. Did they trace the Bitcoin payment? Was it a Silk Road technical snafu or poor buyer-seller tradecraft? Plato, what's your take?
Well, wise guy, unfortunately, I can't really answer your questions because the Australian Federal Police hasn't really given us very much information. We've got a press release that says that a Melbourne man allegedly imported narcotics into Australia via Silk Road. He was charged with 10 offenses relating to the importation, trafficking, and possession of narcotics. It doesn't say what he imported, and it doesn't say how he was caught. This could be anything from a guy who's ordering, you know, 1 gram of weed, and the package rips along the way, and the feds crack down on him, or he could be buying, you know, kilograms of this stuff. We can't really tell. However, one thing that I do want to mention is that this is the second Silk Road related arrest. Recently, we had a New Zealand customs officer order meth through Silk Road, and he volunteered the information and like basically turned himself in. And this was like his 10th meth related offense. It just, I don't know. I thought it was entertaining that someone would hire a customs officer with a bunch of meth offenses.
So is the thought here that perhaps law enforcement is trying to use this as a scare tactic to try to suppress Silk Road when, in fact, they have very little means to catch many of the perpetrators, or if you want to call it the users of Silk Road?
Yeah, probably. I mean, who was it? I think Columbia just did a study saying they estimate $22 million a year passes through Silk Road. That's a lot of volume, and there's plenty going into Australia that they're not finding. My guess is that if it was some giant, if this guy was getting like kilograms of drugs, they would have made a bigger deal about it. They would have told, like, hey, this is what we got.
I think it's much more likely that much of the Silk Road business is done within the country of the person who's actually the buyer, so that it doesn't pass through customs, and it's much more difficult to intercept, whether it's passing through the postal system, a private courier, or people who are using dead drops.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Yeah, I think the main thing, the main danger for most Silk Road people right now is the postal system. Most people are not aware that at every border, packages and letters are routinely scanned. Not every packet, but most of them. Without being opened, I mean, they're using radar systems and x-ray systems and whatever to find out if there's organic content in the package. And they will open it, they'll covertly open it if they have to, and they will even send it along to build a case. So in my opinion, this is a case of someone being caught at the postal checks, so to speak. But as you said, Wise Guy, it's probably a better idea to stay local, to not use cross-border shipments, and to not give your original address, but you know, use a fake mailbox that you put up in some high-rise or something, so you can get away over time. And don't use the same address all the time.
Okay.
It's worth mentioning that Silk Road users aren't on their own. There is the Silk Road forums, which is also a hidden service, Tor hidden service, that is just chock full of information. I won't classify it as good information or bad information because I don't really know. But if you're interested in the tradecraft and what the Silk Road users recommend, the Silk Road forums is full of information.
Certainly true. Hey, Wise Guy, I just want to make one quick correction. I said it was Columbia with that study about Silk Road. I'm mistaken. It was Carnegie Mellon, Professor Nicholas Kristen.
Okay, moving on. It's now widely assumed that all popular instant messaging and voice chat services, many of which promoted privacy, are open to monitoring by the service and law enforcement. Skype, which for years indirectly maintained it could not eavesdrop, is now being conspicuously evasive. Voodoo, if you're a current Skype user or a user of another service and aren't pleased with their treatment of your privacy, what can you do?
There's many things you can do. You can quit using their service. You can switch to a different service that's more in line with what you consider to be your privacy concerns. But all of those carry costs. There's a reason you're using Skype instead of some other service in the first place. And most likely it's because the people that you're actually talking through Skype are using Skype. It's interoperability with another service, I don't think, is there. But there's a cost to that. I mean, just the idea that, okay, well, we've been using Skype and now suddenly I contact somebody and say, you know what, I switched from Skype to this other service. I'd like to communicate with you using this other service. That raises red flags right there. So that's why I think people are really getting up in arms about how cagey Skype is being about these answers. It's a direct question. What is the ability what is your ability to tap into these conversations at the request of law enforcement? They don't even have to answer when or why they would do it or whatever. Just give us the ability, and then users can make a determination on that.
Well, I think the problem starts with the user trusting whatever the media says that Skype said. I mean, there have been records from the 2010 debates in Germany about the use of Trojan horses to intercept encrypted communication, where everyone claimed we need that because we cannot tap into Skype. And Skype was asked, and Skype said, sure, we can. We will help according to the law. I think the big thing with Skype is that they were always able to do that. I mean, if you look at Skype and how it ops, the user never could verify the keys of the party they're communicating with. They were not able to manipulate the routing. So essentially, the users were always open to attacks. But I think what law enforcement really dislikes about Skype is that Skype has to cooperate, and that it's not just some box that you place into the Skype data center to tap into everything like they do with telephone, but that you actually have to tell Skype, I want to listen to these and these people, please prepare for a recording. And I think that is the real issue why so often media and police and whoever spread the meme that Skype is secure. It was never secure, except that the police couldn't go in under the radar.
So one would expect that Google and all of the other commercial services are no more secure or private for individuals than Skype is.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But there are open source alternatives. I mean, there is secure chatting out there, OTR with XMPP or XMPP over OTR or whatever. There are things like ZRTP for voice communication. But as Voodoo already said, there's a cost to using that stuff. The cost is you have to drag all your social network into those technology to be secure.
Have any of you used a program called Jitsi, J-I-T-S-I? It seems to be video chat encrypted and XMPP and stuff like that.
Yeah, that used to be called another product, and it's
SIP communicator.
Exactly, and it had kinds of issues in the past, and there were claims that the code wasn't structured, and it had all kinds of security concerns. Do you know if Jitsi has addressed most or all of them?
No, I haven't used it, but it's the only alternative that I've heard to Skype for, you know, encrypted video communications.
I mean, look at it. Skype never has released their source code. We have no idea how well-structured the source code of Skype is. We have Skype using all kinds of technologies to keep people from reverse engineering the Skype binaries. They're going to great lengths to hide what they're really doing. And there's an open source project that is maybe not perfect, but please, it's probably better than Skype, at least on the trust side.
One thing that you don't hear brought up too much, and I'm going to bring it up right now, is the issue of keystroke logging. And inside of the documents that we've heard, we hear about them recording chat conversations, but they're not talking about the fact that on Windows and on Linux, Skype running on as a graphical user application has access to keystrokes. Now, you know, it may not be actively doing that, or it could be doing it passively, depending on the operating system and how those type of things are done. But at any moment, Skype on a window, even on a Windows machine, can do a DLL injection or whatever, and to log your keystrokes. And I'm not talking about the keystrokes inside of Skype. I'm talking about when you're logging into your bank account. Skype is running in inside of your system tray. It's there. It has access to the GUI. The same thing on Linux. All these people that are running Skype on Linux machines and thinking, oh, okay, well, I'm running it as a separate user in its own directory. Yeah, what that's going to do is going to keep the user process from accessing your other user processes by running in using an SSH with X tunneling. But once any X application, no matter if it's running from the local machine or from another remote machine, once it has access to your X Windows interface to do graphical operations, it has full access to your keyboard. So you're sitting there typing in your root passwords. You're sitting there typing in your Bitcoin wallet passphrase. All of these things, and all you're typing out private messages and using PGP encryption between people and all that while you have Skype loaded in the background, that thing can be sniffing your keystrokes. You have absolutely no idea if it's been sniffing them the whole time. And even though you can say, well, I watch my traffic and I see nothing's going out, you don't know if it's just like storing those inside of one of its internal databases and then periodically sending out a keystroke file. And maybe they're not doing it for everybody, but they could definitely do it for anybody at a push of a button. And they could do it for people at a push of a button based upon certain heuristics inside of their database that show that they want to grab that information from, or the law enforcement says we want all this on all these people, and it's happening. So the keystroke logger, I think, is a huge deal that no one is talking about.
Well, before people are too scared, there are two ways to get around that, or one major way, and that is XNesting. You can use XNest or Zephyr to run Skype in a different X Windows session, so it doesn't have access.
Does that work under Windows?
Right. Yeah, and there was a
good tip.
Windows is not for people that like their privacy.
There was a great ARS Technica article, I want to say about a year ago, about exactly what you're talking about, Hero. And it right in the article, there was a recipe for proving to yourself that your Linux, the GNOME, X Windows was capable of sniffing all those keystrokes like that.
Well, today I learned.
Okay, well, so obviously if you're running, for instance, Skype in your Android phone, and you're worried about those keystrokes being captured, you would want to exit the Skype application, make sure it's not operational, except when you're using Skype for whatever purpose you have. And hopefully it's not injected things into your Android environment that are sniffing your keystrokes after it's exited.
I think we would know if it's really infiltrating the system. We would probably know that there are quite a few people.
I see. So if they were doing that, would have been discovered probably by now.
Unless it's only done very sparsely with targeted people only.
Right. Something where they turn it on and they turn it off.
You know what I wonder is, like a year ago, there was some research saying that using just a microphone and recording the sound of somebody typing on a keyboard, after a couple paragraphs, you have enough information identify the distinctive sound key, and you can get a password like that. I want to know if the microphone on my phone is sensitive enough to do that trick. I mean, my phone may be sitting on the desktop where there's vibrations traveling in from my fingers hitting the keys.
Well, doable by listening to your windows, like the glass windows you have with the laser. There have been experiments doing that.
Yeah, so I think the answer to that is yes. It probably can pick up the sounds. And that's why in all kinds of meetings that require real privacy, although the mobile phones have their batteries removed.
Pen and paper only burned after the meeting.
Exactly. Okay, then. Well, thank you very much for tuning and listening to our service. We hope to have you listening to our next broadcast, which I believe will be in less than a week. I'm Wise Guy, the man with no name, Reality Exploit Roundtable, Episode 4. Thank you very much for tuning in. Hope you listen to our next broadcast.